Welcome to ASEAN New Horizons, where law enforcement practitioners and academics get together to share knowledge and ideas to shape the future of crime analysis.
Hi, I'm Olli Oligschläger. I'm a senior research scientist working with Marinus Analytics, and I have spent about 30 years working in and around the law enforcement, transferring the latest in technology, coming out of academia and making it work in practical law enforcement.
I'm very excited to have you on. Thank you so much for joining me today. You're not in the UK, are you? Do you want to tell the audience where you're from?
Well, I'm originally from Germany. My hometown is Bonn, but I am living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, United States.
Lovely. And I was just asking you about the weather. It's raining currently here and it's all right where you are, but it's great to have you on. I want to start by asking you about your career because I know you've had a really interesting journey.
Sure.
Where did you first start off? How did you get into the industry of law enforcement?
It was a total accident. So my first two degrees, my undergrad and bachelor's and master's degree were in geography, actually, economic geography. And I really got into, at the time, the early 80s, mid 80s, computers were just starting to come into vogue, within academia and everywhere else. And I got into it very early, and I got into GIS, Geographic Information Systems. And then I went to Carnegie Mellon University here in Pittsburgh to work on my PhD in public policy. And about a year or two into my studies, an opportunity came up to explore the use of GIS in law enforcement. And I jumped on it, and that's how I wound up working in law enforcement.
Do you enjoy it?
Love it.
I know you said it was an accident, but now do you believe it wasn't so much an accident, it was meant to be?
Might have been, who knows? But it was, I was an economic geographer, and with, an interest in computer science. And so, yeah, when that came along, it was a National Institute of Justice grant that went on for about 4 years. And for that time, I was full-time embedded in the undercover drug task force here in Pittsburgh. And then later, after 4 years, moved into crime analysis and criminal intelligence. I moved back to Carnegie Mellon to work as a systems scientist. I worked on some Defense Department research, and then went into private industry and started working as a consultant, subject matter expert for various federal agencies and private entities, all working in and around law enforcement.
Yeah. And have you been working in and around law enforcement just where you are based now or around the world?
Around the world. With federal agencies here in the United States, as well as some state and local ones. I've worked for Axon on their body-worn video program, worked on various federal projects, and right now I'm working in my current line of work and within human trafficking. I'm working with law enforcement agencies around the world, including the UK.
Yeah. You've just touched on something there that I wanted to ask you, and what I'll ask you now, actually. You've mentioned human trafficking. So you've done a PhD, you've completed a PhD, and as an academic, you always seek to find gaps. I'm assuming your journey, you've been able to see what different countries do in terms of law enforcement, what's missing, how they can improve. So in terms of safeguarding, what do you say to that and how different countries safeguard their citizens?
It's, There's a big, big difference. So now we're in the realm of human trafficking. So the big difference is between the United States in policing in general and the EU, the UK, and other countries is that traditionally law enforcement in the United States has been much more traditional, less inventive, innovative and progressive than the EU and UK countries have been. That is changing, very, albeit slowly, but it is starting to change, because it's becoming very clear that the UK policing model and the EU policing models are more successful in many respects than the traditional United States policing models are. One big example is in human trafficking. A big problem here in the United States is that because everything is illegal, all forms of prostitution are illegal in most parts of the country, other than a few counties in Nevada. It is much, much more easy for human traffickers to hide amongst all the other illegal activity. Whereas in the UK and in Germany, that's not the case. It's easier, not easy, but easier to identify human traffickers because they can't hide as easily as they can here in the United States.
So you've mentioned that the UK, so do you feel like the UK is further ahead than where the US is now?
In many respects, yes. I mean, we're starting to see a shift here in the United States in the sense that some cities now are moving to decriminalize prostitution. In other words, while it's still illegal, they're simply not prosecuting prostitutes or sex workers is the preferred term. Rather, they are simply not enforcing the law, which can lead to a lot of confusion. In Pittsburgh, for example, which has multiple police departments, some police departments are still enforcing prostitution laws and others are not. So that can lead to a lot of confusion. But on the good end of things, law enforcement agencies in the United States are beginning to realize that sex work is work, but not all sex workers are doing it out of, at will. Of course, some are being trafficked and forced into it, but there are many other reasons why males and females engage in sex work. And those can be simply because they're vulnerable for other reasons. They're making poor, risky choices, especially if they're underage. They're struggling with poverty or homelessness or unemployment, or they have underlying mental health and addiction issues. And this is where the UK has really been an innovator in this regard. So we have been working with some UK agencies over the past year, especially during the pandemic, to identify individuals in the United Kingdom that are engaged in sex work that may only be doing it because they're vulnerable or because they need help. They have no other choice. And this is where the UK is far ahead, and the United States is definitely lagging behind.
And what about in terms of communications and when you're having meetings with, let's say, UK agencies, with yourself and your colleagues, how is that communication between you all? Is there any barriers there?
No, not at all, really. It's actually quite cordial. There, we provide tools to law enforcement around the world to, first of all, identify individuals that might be might be in need of help. So, there's a couple of ways we do this. So, one thing that we do at Marinus is we crawl adverts around the world on various adult escort sites, and then we process those adverts and try to identify, partially on an automated basis, partially through manual searches, individuals that might be in need of help. So, traditionally, there's trafficking vulnerability indicators like lack of detail in the ad, high risk sexual services, lack of choice, numerous linked ads, and so on and so forth. But there's also, we've discovered, and working in partnership with law enforcement, that there are also welfare vulnerability indicators, like somebody who's never worked in the sex industry, especially prior to the pandemic related lockdown, that offer also high risk sexual services, which is a sign of economic desperation, and homelessness or evidence of homelessness, as well as mental or physical health issues and pregnancy. So we have a number of tools that we provide to our law enforcement partners. And those are, first of all, keyword search. So we can search for ads in a particular location that say we're looking for somebody who's say 19 years old, maybe pregnant, has keywords like out of work or unemployed and things like that, which can identify, potentially a person that, lost their job during a pandemic. Maybe they were a bartender or a waitress and for some reason fell through the cracks. An example would be migrants in the UK that are not UK citizens or may not be eligible for economic relief, and then have no choice but to engage in sex work. Other things we have is first appearance. So those are ads that have never been posted anywhere else, just in that location. And then also we have a feature that checks to see if an ad may be a potential be may be posted by a potential juvenile. And it doesn't thus that does also work for child sex trafficking, but it can also identify homeless underage individuals that are engaged in sex work due to, the reasons that I mentioned earlier, homelessness, they've been evicted, their parents kicked them out, they're have mental health issues or drug issues and things like that. And the big difference in the UK with respect to how law enforcement responds is they use a team approach, right? So they team up with social workers and they try to interview the person posting the ad to first of all identify, is that person maybe being trafficked, forced into being trafficked? That's the law enforcement side of it. And if it's not the case, then the social worker will talk to the individual to ask them if they need any help. Do they need mental health services? Do they need help with, medical in medical aspects, for example, in the 19-year-old pregnant girl? Do they need rental assistance and all those kinds of things? And it's a much more holistic approach, and it helps those that are either being forced into sex work or whether through human trafficking or due to economic or other reasons, mental health reasons, it helps them get out of sex work if they are not an at-will sex worker.
I guess during the pandemic, this heightened quite a
Yes.
lot. And how did you find this? How did you find managing this?
The goal here really is to identify those that either due to being forced by an individual or being forced due to individual circumstances into sex work and try to get help them get out of it.
And how do you help them do that? Do you reach out to them and provide that sort of
Well, that's not
one-to-one?
us, right? We provide law enforcement with leads. Like we help them, we provide them with the tools to identify those that are potentially vulnerable. And occasionally we also provide them with leads, ads that we stumble across that we might think, are indicative of somebody who's vulnerable.
This is good. This is a really interesting way of going about it. So you're sort of consulting, I guess, agencies on areas where there are. How successful has this been?
By all accounts, quite successful. I mean, the here in the United States, we've had several cases where numerous victims have been rescued from, that were being forced by individuals to engage in sex work. And in the UK, there have been quite a few examples of, those forced into sex work due to, individual circumstances being helped get out of it and being given the assistance that they need to economically stand on their own 2 feet. And maybe drug counseling, drug treatment, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually going to ask you, what could the UK law enforcement agencies take away from this, technology that you're incorporating in within what you're doing? But actually, I'm going to change that and say, what can the US sort of take away from this? Because you were saying that the UK is further forward. So, what could the US take away from this? I'm guessing you have rolled this out in the US and other places.
Yes, we have. Of course, the laws here are different in the United States. As I said earlier, sex work is illegal everywhere except for two or three counties in one state. So the US is slowly, slowly turning around. I would say it's probably at some point in time, and hopefully not the too distant future, sex work is going to be legalized in some form or another. Probably right now we are where marijuana was about 7, 8 years ago, right? Marijuana is now legal just in at least a third or a half of the states, in the United States. And I think we're going to see the same thing happen to sex work here in the United States. Once it becomes legal, the landscape is going to completely change. I think that states are recognizing that by legalizing marijuana, they are and regulating it, they are bringing in billions and billions of dollars in tax revenue. That's been a complete windfall for them. And I think legalizing and regulating sex work is probably going to result in the same thing. So that's one of the reasons I think it's only going to be a matter of time. And then, of course, the entire landscape is going to change. And like in the UK, and in Germany and elsewhere, hopefully the focus of law enforcement efforts here are going to be focused not on just on arresting sex workers, which is pretty much like shooting fish in a barrel, because they're advertising everywhere, but more focused on safeguarding sex workers, for whatever reason they're engaged in sex work, at least safeguarding those that engage in sex work, due to their individual circumstances or being forced into it by sex traffickers.
When we're talking about this, I can't help but feel that there are still so many sort of knowledge gaps within agencies. How do you get these people on board with what you're trying to achieve?
Well, a big problem in the United States as compared to the United Kingdom or Germany is that Germany has one police department for every state or province. The UK has, I believe, is it 16 major police departments? Something like that. The United States has 19,800 police departments. Ranging, the average police department in the United States is about 10 officers, 10 full-time officers, some part-time officers. Everybody's heard of LAPD or NYPD, so on and so forth, and of course the FBI, the federal agencies. But in most of America, you're looking at very, very small police departments, staffed by volunteers sometimes or by part-timers. They're not paid a lot of money. Some of them are paid not much more than minimum wage. They have to provide their own uniforms and weapons and everything else. And so the level of training and expertise and experience is varies enormously between police departments. So you might have a rural police department in Louisiana or in Alabama or even here in Pennsylvania that has police officers that have had the minimum amount of training, which again varies from state to state. In some states, you can go to an academy for 6 weeks or 9 weeks, maybe 2 months, and you're a police officer. Whereas in Germany, it takes 4 years to become a police officer, and in the UK, a similar amount of time, I think. And then, of course, you have LAPD and you have NYPD that have very rigorous training programs. And then, of course, what police departments do has a lot to do with politics, because
Yeah, absolutely.
in most cities, the police chief is actually subordinate of the mayor. So if the mayor orders the police chief to go after prostitution, that's what the police chief has to do. And it's not necessarily done because it's, the right thing to do, but it's what politically is the thing to do, depending on the geography where they live, so on and so forth. So in the end, there's a huge, huge variation in training and all this kind of stuff here in the United States, and it's really to the detriment of policing overall.
Yeah. what do you think we should be doing? Or well, when I say we, this isn't my area of expertise, but
Right.
people like you that are very, passionate about this in terms of shifting that movement and understanding this better, what do you think those agencies are missing? What needs to be done?
Well, one thing that's really missing here in the United States is some form of national standard for policing. Guidelines and that are, and policing changes constantly, right? The problem, one of the problems is that at least here in the United States, an issue comes up and it becomes a hot button issue, and lawmakers will enact a law and they tackle the issue and think the issue is going to go away. That usually does not happen. An issue doesn't just go away. It kind of morphs. It develops and changes, right? So, for example, criminals are constantly changing their MO, regardless of what field it is, whether it's money laundering or robbery or drug dealing or sex trafficking. It doesn't matter. Crime is always evolving, and criminals evolve, and they evolve as new technology appears, as laws are enacted. So natural policing standards really is an ongoing thing. There should be some form of commission, federal commission, that, like the CDC, for example, or other agencies, public health agencies, periodically give out advice or put out guidelines, for policing. And so as the situation changes, as people's attitude changes, as politics changes, and things like that, they should also be changing their guidelines. One prime example here would be use of force guidelines, right? All the shootings that have occurred, police shootings that have occurred over the past 10 years, there's a desperate need for national standards with respect to use of force in policing.
Yeah, very important. You say you want a sort of a standardized approach. We have that here in the UK. I mean, intelligence at policing, the NIM, the National Intelligence Model. But like you, I found variation in practices. And that can be a problem, right? Because they're sort of meant to be following the same sort of framework strategies to help prevent crime, but there's a variation in how we approach that and how we tackle crime. But I completely agree with you. I definitely think it's something you need. But I'm shocked it's taken, what, we're in 2021 now? It's been a while. Does that worry you? I mean, that's a long time.
It is a long time, but I do have to tell you that compared to 30 years ago, when I first started working with law enforcement in the United States, it seems like 100 years ago. I mean, there has been a lot of positive developments in the United States. It's not definitely not all bad. For one, and at least in major cities, in at the federal level and at the state level, there are a lot of standards emerging. They might all be locally grown, within the state or within a federal agency. But even at in major cities, there are definitely standards beginning to emerge, with respect to use of force and so on and so forth. The problem is that, left to their own, those are going to take decades to trickle down to the smaller police departments. On the adding to the positive trends is that today's new incoming police officer tends to be much more educated than 30 years ago. And that a lot of that is due to police departments mandating, for example, that an applicant has a college degree. And some police departments are even requiring master's degrees for certain positions. And a more educated police force also means, in general, of course, you have a variation there as well, but in general, a more educated police department is usually a more effective police department.
See, I've done a bit of research on that recently for a bit of work that I'm working on. And it's actually an American journal I read, and they said that, yeah, those that are educated help the performance of the police force.
Yes.
And that's really interesting to me because, I mean, surely it'd help if people learned on the job as well. I mean, Ollie, like, you've had so much experience within your career, you could do things that those that are educated cannot.
Yes and no. I mean, it's education in and of itself, right, is no guarantor of success anywhere. Yeah. Obviously, it has to be tied with experience, having good mentors, right? There's a lot of factors that
yes.
contribute to success, right? Just because I have a PhD doesn't mean anything at all with respect to actually being able to do something, you know, in the real world. So I've been very, very fortunate, you know, in my career to have had phenomenal mentors. Some of the people I've worked with have been nothing short of stellar law enforcement officers, whether they were police chiefs or federal agents or crime analysts or undercover drug detectives. Just, it's amazing. I mean, as when I first started working in law enforcement, I was a PhD student. I was 28 years old or 29 years old. And I didn't have a clue about anything. And these people took me under their wings. And if it hadn't been for them, you know, and in ensuing years over time in general, I would not be nearly as good as what I do as I am now in the absence of those people. Right. And so it really takes an entire department of people with solid backgrounds, with good experience combined with education to really make a difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So my question to you, my final question to you, and I really don't want this to come to an end because I do really enjoy talking to you about these topics. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? What do you want to achieve?
Oh, geez.
Sorry.
That's a good question, though. Well, hopefully still doing what I am and at, hopefully at some point being able to retire. but I really hope that at the end of my career, I think one thing my dad always told me is when I grew up, he said, nobody can change the world or very few people can change the world, but everybody can make their portion of the world a little bit better off than it was when they got there. And that really is my goal, you know, within law enforcement to 5 years down the road to have, you know, made some kind of a difference in law enforcement, you know, to improve not only the effectiveness of law enforcement, but also to reduce the number of victims of crime as well.
Yeah, wise words. And you're definitely making a difference. And I am excited for the listeners to hear this podcast and learn about what you are trying to achieve. And if it's okay with you, we'll put your details at the end of the podcast where people can reach out to you and
sure.
ask you further questions, because I know you love to talk about this. We were meant to have a 15-minute conversation a couple of weeks back, and actually it led to over an hour because it was just so interesting what you're trying to do. Ollie, I thank you so much for coming on this podcast, and I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I most certainly did. Thanks for having me, Paige.
We have a new announcement. ASIO are going to be publishing new content, and this will be focusing on crime analysis within Uganda, but also Africa as a whole. My colleague and friend, Emmanuel James Oteng, will be hosting these podcasts, and further information about these will be discussed next by Emmanuel. So keep your eye out for the new Crime Analysis Between the Tropics podcast.
This is Emmanuel James Teng, and I invite you to visit leapodcasts.com on the 2nd and 4th Thursday of the month. Starting from 12th November, I've joined with ACIA and LEA Podcasts to present our Africa series of podcasts. We aim to bridge understanding between Africa and the rest of the analytical world. With shared thought and a common lexicon, we aim to broaden our analysts' worldviews, mitigate cognitive bias, refine analytical tradecraft, and improve investigative outcomes everywhere. Analysis improves through exchange.